far as how we would have three, we will have three very different aspects of engineering presented. The last presentation in this session is Paul Carr. He will be speaking on balance in economics and ethics to save God's creation.
Yes, my talk is a little change in pace. I'm going to be talking about balancing economics with ethics to save God's creation. You might say it's a lead-in to the next session, which is talk about ethics, economics, and the environment. So my goal is to save the EP in our earth because it's the only one with chocolate. Well, I think we're all familiar with the golden rule of ethics. Do unto others as you would do them unto you. I must say that I was a boy growing up in the home of a Methodist minister, and my mother had a ruler, a golden ruler, with do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And to me, that was the golden rule. But as I came mature and made my way in the world, I learned that there's an economics golden rule. And what is that? Yes, he who has the gold makes the rules. Another version of that might be applicable to Washington, D.C. today is we have the best government that gold can buy. But Jesus taught us this commandment, do unto others as you would have them do it to you, as part of the Sermon on the Mount. And his vision was, as expressed in the Lord's Prayer, may thy kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. And his vision was an earthly kingdom in which people would follow the golden rule. And this is largely between each other. But how can this apply to the kingdom, to society, to the world community? Well, I think Pope Francis, his encyclical, Laudato Si, which means praise be, on care for our common home, was the beginning of this, a modern version. He said in this encyclical, among other things, he noticed that market capitalism drives our global economy, and his encyclical questions the ethics of our present system, whose symptoms are climate change and the increasing gap between the rich and the poor. And he noted, any economic system should serve people, not the other way around. And another way of summarizing his encyclical is, let's stop plundering our planet for profit with the poor suffering the most. Well, how can we do that? Well, I think the heart of our problem is that we believe in laissez-faire economics, believe in the invisible hand of Adam Smith while ignoring the tragedy of the commons. Now, The Invisible Hand of Adam Smith, which was first published in 1776, does anyone know the document, familiar with that, where that was published? First publication? Wealth of Nations. That's the best known, but it's actually 1776 publication was published in, Theory of Moral Sentiments, which implied that there was a moral constraint, which we seem to have lost. He said, the invisible hand, which guided the pursuit of individual gain toward the common good or the public interest. And we heard this in Alan Greenspan, the former Fed chair, laissez-faire economics, the self-correcting power of a free market. While ignoring this more modern economic theory, namely the tragedy of the commons, in which William Foster Lloyd said the pursuit of individual good leads to the negation of the common good. So, How do we reconcile these two? Well, let's first talk about the tragedy of the commons. William Foster Lloyd in 1833, and then updated by Garrett Hardin in 1868, he says the pursuit of the individual gain leads to the negation of the common good. And he was familiar with individual herdsmen, with individual owners would own cows, and the commons was owned in common. And so each individual gained by adding more cows to his own herd, his personal wealth would increase. But as each individual had more and more cows, the commons became overgrazed, and the net result is you have starving, malnourished cows. Well, you know, we don't do that today, although I understand in Boston there is still a commons and people have the right to graze their cows there. But what we do is we're now burning coal and other fossil fuels in our common atmosphere. Our new commons is the world atmosphere, and we do that for free for the most part. Now, this is obviously a short-term economic benefit for utility companies and their customers. However, the negative effects of pollution are shared by all. The long-term total cost of burning fossil fuels is not included what we now pay. Carbon dioxide will be in our atmosphere for over 100 years. In addition to these aerosols, carbon dioxide is around for at least 100 years, and it's warming our planet. Well, of course, the cost of coal burning is really unjustly distributed, particularly for people who live near power plants. We estimate that they're the lives of like 30,000 people per year are cut short by asthma attacks, cardiac problems, and upper and lower respiratory problems associated with the fine particles from the power plants that get in their lungs. And in addition, let's not forget the number of deaths from coal miners. We remember that those coal miners that were in Chile that were underground, and also there was the owner of a power plant in West Virginia is now in jail because many miners died because they weren't following the safety requirements. And so we've lost many coal miners, none from nuclear reactors in the U.S. Seems to be a double standard here. If we'd lost that many people in nuclear reactors, we might not. It'd probably all be shut down, but we haven't shut down coal mines for that reason. Another an illustration of the aerosol problem is in Beijing here, in a very smoggy day, you can see all the aerosol particles reflecting the light back into space, so it's very dark even though the sun is shining, and schools must often be closed, and you can see oftentimes the aerosol levels are much higher than the World Health Organization safe level. 1 million people die early deaths globally from aerosol pollution. So, you know, that really isn't cost into our present economic system. Health costs of coal burning really aren't priced in. So, here's one of the effects of global warming. This plot here, we notice that the temperature, this is the average, this is the temperature or deviation from the anomaly, from 1880 to 1980, was quite modest. The temperature increased roughly by 4/10 of a degree C. Now, given this data and his knowledge of what happened on Venus, you know, Venus has an atmosphere of carbon dioxide, which is about 100 times thicker than on the Earth, and Venus has a temperature hot enough to melt lead. And so knowing this, of the power of the greenhouse effect and global warming, he predicted back in 1981 with this data available to him that carbon dioxide warming should emerge from the noise of natural variability. And you can see since 1981, the temperature has increased dramatically compared to what it did in the century before. And this was all predicted by Hansen ahead of time. 2016 and 2015 have been the warmest years of record, and as you can see there, that these temperatures are well above this green trend line. Well, maybe because this prediction came true, we should take seriously his present prediction. This is published just last year in Atmospheric and Chemical Physics. And he was the first author of a team of about 13 authors. And these include an international team from a laboratory in France and also China. I just wanted to illustrate that this is an international team. And what are they predicting? particularly for sea level rise, from ice melt, from the warming Earth. Well, the most likely prediction that Hansen believes is this first one in green, that sea levels will rise up to about a meter, that's about 3 feet, by 2050. I think since two-thirds of our world cities are located on the ocean, I think the world will take this seriously and say we've got to do something serious. But we only have 9 years. You can see this exponential rise, that once we've seen this danger, it's going to be pretty much too late, because in 9 years, sea levels will have gone up to 5 meters, and by 2058, and realize that carbon dioxide is not going to go away for like 100 years. Just to give you some feel for what 5 meters does, in the state of Florida, we have Miami underwater, and Trump's Mar del Lago may well be underwater well before we have 5 meter rise. Maybe this is the reason why Trump's daughter Ivanka is more concerned about global warming. She advised him to stay in the Paris Agreement, but he's not going to live that long. He may not live to see that. But his daughter's concerned about her inheritance. Well, we must act now or swim later. This is a placard, that picture I took of this young lady in the Mosque for Science on Earth Day on April 22nd. Well, what's the best solution? What can make a difference? Well, let's just have a look at our carbon dioxide emissions per capita. We've on a per capita basis, we've always been the world's biggest carbon dioxide emitter. China, since about 2000 or so, as you can see, is now basically up to Europe. In terms of total emissions, carbon, China is the largest, but on a per capita basis, since their population is roughly four times the United States, we're still ahead. Well, let's have a look at what the price, how economics, the hidden hand of Adam Smith, can reduce our carbon dioxide emissions. What was the price of gasoline back in 1960? Yeah, about 25 cents, 30 cents a gallon, something like that. I can remember that back in 1980, it turns out our U.S. oil production peaked, and the price of oil increased dramatically up to a factor of 3. And guess what? Our carbon emissions per capita took a dramatic drop. I personally lived in a house that had an oil burner, and most of the oil was going up the chimney in a traditional brick chimney. And I converted to a very efficient natural gas boiler. It was so efficient, like 90% efficient. It was so efficient that I didn't need that chimney. The little bit of carbon dioxide coming off went out in a plastic pipe out the side of the house. So that's how, just shows you how the hidden hand of economics, when prices go up, our use goes down. Also, let's have a look at Europe. Price of gasoline is, this morning's plenary speaker mentioned, is about twice that in the U.S. And guess what? Their carbon dioxide per capita emissions are comparable to the U.S. and they're a developed country just as we are. I might say that also their public transportation is much better, much more available, and much more of it. So we see that the power of, and of course our recent decrease in carbon dioxide is again through the economics that natural gas is cheaper than coal. For the same amount of energy, the gas gives you half the carbon dioxide emissions of coal. So there again, we see the power of economics. So how can we harness this power to decrease our carbon dioxide emissions? Well, here's a proposal by George Shultz, who was Reagan's professor, Secretary of the Treasury, and he's proposing a revenue-neutral carbon fee with dividend for everybody. This would, of course, make carbon dioxide emitters gasoline, oil more expensive. The average person would have to pay more for gasoline, more for heating. But his proposal is that the money from this carbon fee would be returned to everybody to pay for their higher energy bills initially. It could be as high as $2,000 per family or four. And so the poor, the people at the lower end of the economic spectrum would have the money. In the long run, the higher costs of carbon emitting fuels, or burning of carbon fuels, would aid green technology, stimulate green technology innovation. And also the average people at the bottom of the economic ladder spend their money on goods and services, not on yachts and second homes or money squirreled away in Switzerland or whatever. They spend it on goods and services. It goes into our economy, and we create the estimated 2 million jobs. So it looks like a win-win in the sense that reduced carbon dioxide emissions, stimulated green technology, and basically we would be harnessing our desire for profit. Our greed would be harnessed toward green technology, and we'd be paying the carbon emitters would be paying the true social costs of burning fossil fuels, the social and environmental costs, which I've described to you. You remember Catherine Hayhoe is on the board of directors of the Citizens Climate Lobby. You can go to their webpage and read more details. Citizens Climate Lobby. George Shultz is also on the board of directors. So this is would be, I think, the most effective way of cutting back of our and in a sense, a community that could be. As a matter of fact, part of this, by the way, part of this carbon fee, and we should mention, let's not call it a tax. That's a pejorative term for certain political people, and we need to call it a revenue neutral carbon fee plus dividend. So, I talked about green technology, and let me give you some examples that may not be that familiar. Here's this book called Super Fuel, Thorium, the Next Green Source for the Future. We had to talk about nuclear a little bit this morning and the importance of it. It's a little bit interesting to note the history of thorium reactors. It was originally demonstrated back at Oak Ridge under Alvin Weinberg in 1970, and it turns out its fission byproducts have no weapons value, which during the nuclear war arms race was not advantageous, but it would be today. And also it has zero chance of a meltdown. These reactors are designed to, if they get too hot, they shut down automatically. Well, it turns out that thorium reactors lost to the Navy's Admiral Rickover, who was developing our present generation reactors, our uranium water cooled, and mainly the original development came for nuclear submarines and aircraft carriers. There was big government money during the Cold War for this, and so that technology was developed for the Navy. And so our present civilian reactors, which generate 20% of our electricity at present, without carbon emissions, are a spinoff from Rickover's Navy technology. But this is an example of technology that would be motivated by a carbon fee plus dividend. Of course, one of the problems is the waste with our traditional reactors. They say the waste problem would be less with thorium, but Bill Gates is spending his megabucks together with the Chinese National Nuclear Corporation. And this is for a TerraPAR nuclear pilot plant being built in China, and the economic, safety, waste, and all key parameters that are drastically improved. And this traveling wave reactor converts depleted uranium, a byproduct of the present nuclear fission process, into usable fuel. So this has the potential to solve the nuclear waste problem. This is under development in China. I mentioned, here's a video I'd like to call to your attention. How the fear of nuclear power is hurting our environment. It's a YouTube video, about 20 minutes, I'd recommend to you. But basically, just to put this in perspective, solar energy is nuclear. The environmentalists love solar. Let's remember, it's nuclear. It's basically comes from the fusion of hydrogen into helium in our sun. And solar energy, is available about 26% of the time because the sun doesn't shine at night, and then when it's cloudy, that also cuts down. And wind is 33% of the time. Nuclear is available all the time. So basically, to summarize his 16-minute video, these are his figures. Basically, we're worldwide, we're decreasing our energy we get from nuclear by about 7%. And this is greater, this decrease is greater than the increase that we're getting from solar and wind. And this is particularly true in Germany, where Germany has enough solar and wind so that when the sun is shining, the wind is blowing, they have more electricity than they can use, and they're paying their neighboring countries. They actually pay them to take that energy off their hands. They don't have that much storage, apparently. And turns out electricity costs are twice that in the U.S. And if you remember the speaker this morning, he pointed out that electricity costs in Germany are greater than the U.S. and France. France gets about 80% of its energy electricity from nuclear. And its carbon dioxide emissions are substantially lower than in Germany right now. So here's another placard from the Science March. Nothing in life is to be feared, it is only to be understood. And this is from Marie Curie, who did some of the initial research and won a Nobel Prize in around 1900 for her research on radioactivity. Well, here's a quote from, Ian Hutchinson that you heard this morning. Shortly after I read this headline, Trump could fuel a nuclear energy boom in the United States in 2017. I asked him what he thought about this. This was after he gave a lecture at Gordon College, an ASA lecture at Gordon College. And he said, the Republicans are less scared of nuclear energy than the Democrats. So MIT also is interesting, is designing tethered offshore nuclear reactors. This gets rid of the NIMBY problem. And one of the other advantages is, of course, nuclear reactors do require cooling water, and obviously there's plenty of it in the ocean. And it gets rid of the NIMBY problem, and apparently the cost is substantially lower than present reactors. Well, in conclusion, economics can be balanced with ethics by requiring carbon emitters to pay for their true human and environmental costs. A revenue-neutral fee and dividend for all would stimulate our economy and give non-carbon-emitting technology an advantage. Now, a comparable program would be the carbon emissions and cap and trade, cap emissions and trade for permits that exceed the cap. This is being used in California, and also the regional greenhouse gas initiative in the New England states. But it doesn't, the advantage of the carbon, the fee plus dividend, the carbon cap and trade, the people at the bottom of the economic are still going to have to pay, more for their fossil fuels, and the advantage of the carbon fee is that it gives them the money to pay for it. This is an article that just came out in The Economist, a green red herring. The goal should be to curb global warming, not 100% renewable energy. Too much emphasis on wind and solar blocks off better alternative, better carbon reduction paths, such as nuclear. Also conservation, obviously. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. We have time for about 5 minutes of questions, so I'll let you call on the people.
Yes.
So would you also change some of the current incentives and rebates for things like solar if we had like a country-wide carbon tax, or even worldwide, to try to level things out? We still have a very confusing array of incentives and things. It might be worth simplifying things.
Right. Matter of fact, I think Professor Hutchinson mentioned that there are large subsidies for fossil fuels that have been in place over the last century. And the straightforward thing might be, let's eliminate all. As a matter of fact, I think the fossil fuel subsidies, at least worldwide, the numbers I've seen about four times are greater than for green, like wind and solar. So if one just were to eliminate all subsidies, green energy would be ahead. So that would be a straightforward, but I think the fossil fuel industry would fight.
I don't know if it's politically, but that's a good point. Yes.
So if you think of carbon dioxide as a waste from fossil fuels, then you also have nuclear waste. Neither one of those has been solved, and these big industries are just continuing to dump things into the commons, and these are huge global public policy issues. So I don't think nuclear is any more of an answer than fossil fuels.
Well, I think if you, carbon dioxide is global. Nuclear is, has anyone visited a nuclear reactor, by the way? Has anyone seen the storage? Right now they store it on site. Anyone seen how big those storage areas are? Yes?
I'm a Navy nuke. I spent years on a submarine. They're teeny compared to the other problems.
Right. As I say, I saw the storage, and it was quite small. The storage here, that's, I think, a lot smaller than the carbon dioxide that's all around the world, and it's hard to get a handle on it. And it, of course, we have, as far as the storage issue, we built the nuclear plants were taxed to build, was it Yucca Flats? There's a storage facility in where's it, Arizona?
Nevada, yes.
But politically, Harry Reid was from Nevada, and he said, "Not in my backyard." And but now that he is no longer in power, this is one way the Republicans in power might decide to use that facility, which the nuclear reactors have been already paid for, and it's already largely built. So. More questions?
Well, one point I think on the nuclear side, I think on top of the economic considerations and the efficiency considerations, especially it seems to be with nuclear power, probably more than any other energy sources, is the social acceptance side, right? That's the one of the biggest problems with nuclear is the sense of fear of radioactivity, right? Radioactivity is persistent, it lasts for tens of thousands of years,
right.
But it's very hard to pin down, you know, what level of risk is it, but it freaks people out. And,
right. That's absolutely true. That's why I emphasized, my first pro-nuclear was basically this R&D, Bill Gates is funding this new reactor, this TerraPower reactor, which will basically take the spent nuclear fuel, which has like 98% of the nuclear energy still in it, and use it as an energy source for the specially designed reactor, which is designed to burn up the spent nuclear reactor of our older technology. So there's a technology principle solution for it, which is not that well known. And not. Yes?
Yeah, I'm a strong believer in market forces. Also, I'm sitting here trying to understand how the revenue neutral dividend would encourage person to conserve. I guess that's an idea. But, if I spend $1,000 a year in gasoline, and I get $2,000 back, and after the tax is put on, $3,000, there's no difference. So how is that driving conservation?
Well, I think the hope is that concerned me too when I first heard about it. But nevertheless, it would still make fossil fuels more expensive because basically they're having to pay a fee, whereas green energy is not. So it would make, if you look at that balance, if you look at that just from the fact that if petroleum producers are going to have to pay this fee, they'll raise the cost of gasoline, and that will give it an economic disadvantage to wind, solar, and nuclear, from that point of view.
One more question. With regard to the waste, I read a book on thorium. I don't know if it was that one or some other book, but I believe it said that the waste products from it had half-lives, so it was like tens of years rather than tens of thousands. Is that correct?
What was this again? That was
of waste?
Of the thorium reactor is much shorter, I believe.
I believe so, and there's less of it, as I understand it. There's less of it. In other words, the thorium reactors use more of the energy. Our present reactors apparently only use like 2 to 3% of the total energy available. And so the spent nuclear fuel has lots of energy in it, but we don't use it. And so we have to store it. But hopefully this TerraPower reactor will use it as a burn it. We'll get the rest of the energy out and solve the waste problem.
Thank you very much.